I next met with Dr. Nikhil Munshi to chat about multiple myeloma and to get a better idea of how he integrates new research findings into his practice. I asked Dr. Munshi to present a few cases, and he began with a 61-year-old man.
This was a relatively younger, healthy, active 61-year-old gentleman in good health otherwise. Went to his physician for his regular checkup and was found to have proteinuria. Further workup, as normally is done for physical examination, was detected to have creatinine of 2.5 milligram per deciliter. That led to more extensive investigation, and he was detected to have serum IgG of 3,400 milligram per cent, free lambda light chain of 210 milligram per deciliter, led to bone marrow examination, which showed 40% clonal plasma cell lambda type with some abnormal forms, with normal cytogenetics, and his hemogram was 8.9, and skeletal survey did not show any lytic lesion and had normal calcium.
Can you kind of summarize what your thinking was in terms of his options at that point?
So basically, he's a young transplant-eligible patient who has presented with creatinine, which is elevated in the setting of previous creatinine being normal, so he had a normal renal function. He did not have any other causes for renal failure, meaning no diabetes or hypertension in his history, and clearly has a diagnosis of myeloma based on presence of paraprotein, as well as bone marrow plasmacytosis, and the end organ damage being anemia and renal failure. So this is a patient who is a transplant candidate, has renal failure, which obviously is connected with his myeloma and requires induction treatment that will take care of his myeloma and improve his renal function so that we can proceed with everything else we can do for future.
So can you talk a little bit about how you think through various options for initial induction in a patient like this who's transplant eligible and how that changes in the face of renal failure?
So in general, in absence of renal failure, three-drug regimens are clearly superior to two-drug regimen. There are a number of studies which have confirmed. There's a, now I would call an older study that checked Tel-Dex versus bortezomib, thalidomide Dex, and showed the VTD is better. Similarly, there are studies done that shows that three-drug regimen of VCD, bortezomib, cytoxan, Dex, or RVD, lenalidomide, bortezomib, Dex, provides close to 95 to 100% responses compared to two-drug regimen. So in any newly diagnosed, younger, relatively healthier patient, three-drug regimen is what one should use. The most commonest and the one which I would prefer in general is a combination of lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone because it provides 100% response, PR or better, almost close to 75% VGPR, and almost close to 35 to 40% CR rates by itself.
So before you go on, I'm curious about what you just said in terms of three-drug regimens. Sagar Lonial was on our last program, and I was asking about this editorial he had written, and it was JCO about this question. And you know, one of the things I hear a lot from oncologists, and I think it's coming out of their experiences in other cancers like breast cancer, is in the long run, yeah, that's fine. Short term, you see better response rates. But what evidence do we have that in the long run, it's better to start with three drugs as opposed to maybe holding one, for example, holding lenalidomide for maintenance?
So I think lenalidomide still would be for maintenance, but there is really nice emerging data that getting the best response, and we are now getting into the territory of discussing minimal residual disease, that patient achieving an MRD negative status provides better outcome, not only in regards to progression-free survival, but also getting towards overall survival improvement. And so whatever treatment we use that provides the highest chance of getting into minimal residual disease, measured by flow cytometry, measured by molecular technology, is the one which we should go to get there. And it is clear that the depth of responses do end up being better with three-drug compared to two-drug. And so there is a reasonably clear rationale of using the three-drug regimen that will provide us with better depth of response that allows better transplantability, but also in the long run, probably survival outcomes.
So how has your approach to upfront treatment changed, if at all, in the face of renal failure?
So that's a very important next point for this patient. So RVD is a standard treatment. However, lenalidomide is excreted through the kidney, and that in a patient with renal failure, it can accumulate and cause toxicity. Mainly the one which I would look at would be cytopenia. So in this particular given patient, a better alternative to start with will be to use Cytoxan instead of lenalidomide. So we could use bortezomib, Cytoxan, dexamethasone, given in a standard dose, at least for 2 cycles. And my guess would be, and in this patient in reality, we achieved a very good response with normalization of the renal function. At that point, in a practical setting, not in an academic setting where we would be doing studies, in a practical setting, one could switch over to lenalidomide-based combination, changing from BCD to RVD, get the best response, and then go for transplant.
And what about the issue of transplant? You all at Dana-Farber have a large trial looking at this internationally in terms of upfront versus delayed transplant. Are you still putting patients on that study? And outside of a study, do you consider transplant routine?
So we have an ongoing study which has actually finished the accrual in the French side. 700 patients have been accrued on the U.S. side. We are making good progress with over 150 patients enrolled. So we have close to 900 patients enrolled on this study where patients are being randomized to receiving RVD alone versus RVD with transplant. Critical question being, does transplant add to improved progression-free survival, improved achievement of minimal residual disease, and eventually overall survival? So we do have that ongoing study. So when we go to the clinical, regular day-to-day practice setting, while we wait for the result of this study, we have to use the currently available data. Now, in many patients, based on the previous at least 2 different studies, there was a Jean-Paul Furman's old study, which said early versus late transplant doesn't make a big difference. There was a SWOG study, 93-21, published by Dr. Parlaghi, showed something similar, that early versus late transplant using the old drugs, not the novel drug, achieves very similar outcomes. One could argue that maybe in a given patient, we can delay the transplant. However, there are certain circumstances where I would not want to delay the transplant. And those circumstances, this patient fits one of those descriptions. If patient presented with renal failure, if he delayed the transplant, which may allow earlier progression of the disease, he may have renal failure again. And in which setting, we don't know the reversibility, he may not be a transplant candidate, etc. So he's one of the person where I would do early transplant, get a better response that lasts longer, he has a better quality of life. Another similar situation in my consideration would be somebody with a lot of bone disease. So patient presents with a lot of bone fractures, bone lesions, collapsed spine. If we wait for in that patient, when he relapses, he'll have more bone lesions, more problems, poor quality, poor general health and quality of life. So those are the few situations where I would definitely recommend that we should do early transplant. In other, it becomes a discussion with the patient. I would still prefer that early transplant is done. For whatever reason, patient prefers to delay it, we could discuss and delay it for a later time. But certainly collect their stem cells earlier on in the induction part of the treatment so that we do have stem cells collected.
I'm curious, when you decide whether or not to put a patient on the study, you know, what are the kinds of patients you would put on the study? And for example, you brought up a couple situations. Would you put a patient with extensive bone disease on the study?
Yeah, so that's a very good question, and it kind of might sound contradictory, but every patient coming in who is young and otherwise eligible for this should go on this study because we're trying to answer the question. The thing we do outside of the study are without significant results. So you could argue that patients with renal failure, if we delayed the transplant, when he relapses, we reinduce him. Would he become normal? And what are the percentages that his renal function will not become normal? We don't have that data. This is just a precautionary way of treating these patients. So anybody less than 65, otherwise cardiorespiratory functions are normal, who can get RVD safely, should go on this study. Now, if patient has a renal failure like this patient, he won't be eligible for the study because he has upfront renal failure. He won't be able to go on the study anyway.
Interesting. So can you bring us up to date on this man? What's his current situation?
So he got initially VCD combination 2 cycle followed by RVD, achieved near CR with this treatment. His stem cells were collected and then he underwent melphalan 200 based high-dose chemotherapy followed by transplant. He achieved true CR with immunofixation negativity. He was treated in a time when we were not routinely measuring MRD, although we would do it now, but at that time he didn't. But he had a true CR, which has now been sustained for around 2.5 years. In the interim, he did get, after getting his transplant, he did get 2 cycles of RVD as a consolidation, followed by maintenance on lenalidomide, which he is currently continuing.
And how did he tolerate the pre-transplant treatment, the transplant, and the maintenance treatment?
He did exceedingly well. He was one of those patients who did not develop neuropathy, had no major problem. The creatinine normalized very quickly. His transplant course was relatively uneventful, except for predicted short duration of cytopenic fever, good bone marrow recovery, and all the other functions normalized quite subsequently, and has received maintenance treatment without any major problems.
Now, I'm curious, in the two initial treatments, how was the bortezomib given in terms of route of administration and schedule?
So bortezomib was given to this patient in the standard fashion. It was given intravenously twice a week for 2 weeks on, 1 week off. He did not have neuropathy, and we continued to do it intravenously. He could have been switched over to subcutaneous with probably similar outcome.
And if he were being treated today, would he still get the bortezomib that way?
So patients who have renal failure, we tend to have initial treatment IV. There's no clear data that IV could be superior to subcutaneous in that setting. But those who have renal failure, for example, where we do need to get right pharmacokinetic parameters achieved for response, they initially get IV. If they have no problems, they could continue, but could be very easily switched over to sub-Q after initial improvement in the renal function, etc.
Other than the initial couple cycles of treatment in special situations like renal failure, are you generally using sub-Q bortezomib in your induction RVD?
More or less, yes. It is not routine. We still have some variability. But yes, sub-Q has become quite a routine.
So we got a couple of questions at a symposium we did recently. I'll pass on to you about sub-Q bortezomib. The first was, do you still use sub-Q if you, quote, need a response quicker? I don't know whether, you know, maybe the patient's ill or for some reason you want to get treatment on board quicker. Would you still use sub-Q? And the other question about sub-Q we got I thought was interesting is, do you use it in very obese people?
So answer to both, we do use IV when we need a quicker response, like this patient, because of renal failure, we give IV to start with. The fact that patients do get neuropathy with IV more frequently than sub-Q also tells you about its pharmacokinetic, that its Cmax is higher. And no detailed studies are done to say if that translates into better response, but that's a bias. So place where we want the quick response, we do give it IV. The obesity is a very good question. Again, the sub-Q versus IV pharmacokinetic studies have not been done, keeping obese patient in mind. And so it's a two-way thing. Obese patients have a more difficult time getting IVs in, so sub-Q is much easier for them. So unless he's extremely obese, we would use exactly the same algorithm that we use in relatively leaner patient.
So I assume the main issue here with the obese patient is absorption?
I think the main question might be absorption. And with the fat being there, when you put subcutaneously and there's a thick layer of fat, I think his question might be, if the drug goes to the fat layer, would it be seeping into in adequate fashion, and or do you get suboptimal level, systemic level, that you would need to get for anti-myeloma response? So compared to leaner person, an obese person, when given subcutaneously, may have lower than required circulating liver that reaches bone marrow, or it might take a longer time to get there, so the livers are lower but longer. And that may be inadequate. And there's an old study where Dr. Jagannath did many, many years ago when he compared 1.3 versus 1.0. And theoretically, one could argue that giving sub-Q to an obese person is like giving 1.0 dose, so you get a lower level. And that study, although not powered for comparison, did show that 1.30 had a little bit lower responses. So there would be some concern in regards to that.
That's interesting. We've seen two new agents approved in myeloma recently, carfilzomib and pomalidomide. Are there any situations where you might consider these agents as part of upfront therapy? And I particularly would be curious about carfilzomib in a patient with pre-existing neuropathy or maybe just pre-existing diabetes.
So if somebody has pre-existing neuropathy, carfilzomib may be an interesting agent to use. There's excellent data that if you combine carfilzomib with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, you get responses and you can give in quick responses with this three-drug combination. So if neuropathy is a problem, one could surely consider carfilzomib in that patient, especially as you mentioned, diabetes or other similar disease-related neuropathy. pomalidomide, there is less data in newly diagnosed patients. It has not been used in newly diagnosed setting. It is a very powerful drug. It is a very active drug. There are a number of studies being done to combine it with bortezomib pomalidomide dex. There's a study looking at carfilzomib pomalidomide dex. We do not have enough data at the moment to say that I would use pomalidomide up front. Lenalidomide provides excellent response, so pomalidomide could be our backup for relapse setting. But carfilzomib has data and so should be considered, especially in the setting where patient may have significant or at least neuropathy of significant extent to not use bortezomib up front.
Any predictions about whether, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years from now, we are going to be using either one of these agents up front?
I'm quite sure both the agents will be evaluated in due time in newly diagnosed setting. Fact that pomalidomide does work when lenalidomide stops working tells us that it has activity which is different, if not better, than what lenalidomide is. And if you look at the structure, pomalidomide is like a combination of thalidomide and lenalidomide structure. So there is something more to it than just either of the drug by themselves. So I would predict that at some point studies would be done and pomalidomide would become one of the agents to be used in newly diagnosed setting. Carfilzomib will have to still wait and see what the toxicity profile ends up being, whether any cardiac issues that have been discussed, was discussed at ASCO a little bit, does make a difference, etc. But in absence of that, it also works when bortezomib stops working. So it has activity which is being irreversible, might provide some benefit that could be used in newly diagnosed settings. So theoretically, we could envision carfilzomib pomalidomide dex as a combination.
So I want to ask you about the maintenance treatment this man got, but one other question about induction, which is you mentioned he had normal cytogenetics. What kind of cytogenetic findings will change what you do? And how do you change it, again, in the upfront setting? Do you change the type of induction? I've heard people talking about changing the type of maintenance. Which findings do you look for, and how does it change what you do?
So upfront, very little to change based on cytogenetics. They wouldn't get RVD. Three-drug regimen is good, and it works in either of the setting. There is clear evidence that bortezomib can overcome 414 translocation. Then lenalidomide is similar activity. So I think upfront induction treatment doesn't change. What may be affected is subsequent, given consolidation and, quite importantly, type of maintenance one may consider. So if somebody has 17p deletion, which otherwise still remains a subgroup of myeloma with poor outcome despite all the new drugs or whatever other things we do, and to some extent 414 translocations too and 1416, these are the group of patients where we need to have more intensive treatment. They would benefit from consolidation. That's what is considered. We don't have clear proof yet in this subgroup patients. And also, when it comes to maintenance, one may want to consider not just one but two drug maintenance. So you could use lenalidomide and bortezomib or similar maintenance for a longer period of time. More importantly, younger patients with possible match, these are the patients 17p deletion, should be considered for possible allogeneic transplantation, knowing that their outcome could be quite poor. Now, one of the issues that has come up is also makes it a little bit more complicated that just 17p deletion, few cells having it may not mean as much. There is data from the French group, Professor Ravelou-Azo, that if 60% cells contain 17p, that is the poor prognosis. And so meeting that criteria, one could consider more aggressive intervention moving forward.
Any other abnormalities that change what you do besides 17p?
So there are always emerging newer markers that come up. So you can say 1Q addition or 1P deletion that appear to be having poor prognosis. I don't think they're validated well enough yet to use it. There's a 17-gene signature which has been out there. There's a 92-gene signature which is out there, which identifies around 15-20% of the patient who may have poor prognosis. However, it is not clear how many of them are not picked through 17P deletion and or 414. So further classification are, I think, more in the research setting. For a day-to-day practice, I would just focus on this.
So in terms of post-transplant therapy, I wanted to get your current take on maintenance. You talked a little bit about that, but also this issue of consolidation, how you approach that decision, and whether you think this is being done generally by investigators as well as docs in practice.
So I think consolidation is usually not done by physicians in practice. It is more on the academic setting where it is considered. It is not, even in academic setting, off protocol not being done routinely. It is more on the basis of a judgment that patient is an aggressive disease presented with plasma cell leukemia. Maybe a consolidation would help. So it is more done in a higher risk patient population, cytogenetic abnormality, plasma cell leukemia, high LDH, plasmablastic disease, are the settings where knowing that patient has poor prognosis, consolidation is considered off protocol.
Although you did it in this man.
Yeah, so in this man, we did it because he only got 3 cycles of RVD upfront after the VCD. So we wanted to consolidate with a higher number of cycles.
Interesting. And what about the issue in terms of using maintenance or consolidation? Do you generally utilize it? And does the response status change what you do?
So we utilize maintenance in every patient. I think that's a standard of care for all our patients. And response status, as long as they've achieved a good PR or better, or a PR or better, would get maintenance. Now, just RVD provides 75% patient with VGPR. Transplant increases it further. So large majority of the patients do achieve a very good response that will then be an indication for going on maintenance.
What about the duration of maintenance?
So we have continued maintenance till progression. Again, that's a moving target. Every year, people increase 1 year to the maintenance to the next year. But I think there is emerging data that 2 years or more is required. So minimum 2 years has shown benefit. There are ongoing studies, 2 years versus indefinite. There's a study of 1 year versus indefinite, etc. In our own study, the transplant versus no transplant study, on the French side, because of some regulatory issues, the maintenance was 1 year. On the US side, the maintenance is indefinite. And so the current practice of protocol would be to continue maintenance if no toxicities are observed and patients are tolerating it well.
We got a comment also at one of our symposium recently I'd like you to respond to, which said, why give maintenance since it doesn't affect survival? Agree or disagree?
Totally disagree. I think there is a very clear evidence of overall survival benefit in the CLGB study. There is clear trend towards improvement in the FRIEND study. Again, when you do transplant and a number of other intervention, it takes longer to get the difference. But I think there's a clear trend. There's also a subgroup analysis presented at one of the meetings, which looked like that in a subgroup of patients earlier on, now there is an improvement in overall survival. So I think maintenance does provide overall survival benefit.
It's funny, you know, just sitting here talking to you, I flash through all these questions. We get so many emails and questions, and they just sort of pop into my head. And I remember one we got recently that was really interesting. There was a patient who'd gotten, you know, typical lenalidomide maintenance and then developed a basal cell cancer of the skin on the nose. And the doc said, well, I assume this was related to the lenalidomide. Agree or disagree?
Disagree.
What do we know about the types of second cancers that are seen?
I think the thing that we have to be careful about, the myeloid problem. So patient having MDS or some other pre-leukemic type of changes that you observe could be considered as related with lenalidomide in some way. It's kind of ironic that one of the treatment for MDS is lenalidomide, but those are the changes which are observed. We have data that very well discussed and published that lenalidomide does affect stem cell mobilization. So we do know there is effect on the stem cells. And so any myeloid change would make me definitely change the treatment, stop the treatment, and observe patient without the thing. There is some controversy about lymphoid malignancy and or lymphoid change. On the French data, there was more incidence of lymphoid changes. There were some few more lymphoma cases in patients who got lenalidomide versus placebo. On the US side, it was myeloid. So the jury is still out on the lymphoid problem, whether lymphocytosis or any other lymph node problem is observed. Solid tumor, I think, is becoming less and less clear about its effect on developing solid tumor, and that would not become an issue to stop the treatment and or attribute it to lenalidomide.
So let's talk about your second patient. Any case that starts out with an 84-year-old patient always gets my interest. So what happened here?
So he's a relatively older patient with quite a few comorbidities. He had peripheral edema, mild congestive heart failure, he had hypertension, also diabetes with mild peripheral neuropathy. And he presented with fatigue and with so many symptoms. Fatigue could be attributed to a lot of comorbidities. Eventually, laboratory workup showed anemia, normal renal function, but had an M spike, which was clearly high at 3.7 grams per deciliter with an IgG lambda type. and underwent bone marrow, which showed 60% plasma cell, and the skeletal survey showed number of lytic lesions from skull, spine to pelvis. He didn't have bone pain, but he had number of lesions. So clear case of multiple myeloma with both paraproteinemia and bone marrow plasmacytosis with clear end organ damage with bone disease and anemia.
So can you talk about how you thought through various options for this patient and how, if at all, they were changed by the presence of the various comorbidities? Particularly, I'm curious about the diabetes with neuropathy.
Yeah, so I think this patient actually kind of highlights the problem in older patients. And calling them transplant ineligible is inadequate because we are artificially dividing them from transplant to no transplant. He's a patient I would call older patient with comorbidities, which is what we are beginning to see much more now, that patients live much longer. And it's not just the age by number. Somebody could be 75 and very healthy. And we have seen patients 65 and feeling like 84. This gentleman has a number of problems. And so the comorbidity and its impact on the health is a critical issue in this patient when we consider treatment. So, for example, in this case, neuropathy adds up another angle that actually you ask about the younger patient. Would he be able to get bortezomib? And that's a drug I would not use in this patient up front at the standard dose and schedule. One would want to consider alternatives for this. Another issue that ends up is this comorbidities decreases the functionality of the patient, becomes frail, their performance status, the cognitive functions are not good. We need to keep that in mind. They may not be able to take complex regimen if we give them evening, morning, afternoon dosages. And then we have to remember polypharmacy, what else they are taking that can interact with what we do if they are taking Coumadin, if they are taking other ACE inhibitors or other things that could have effect. And then their ability to tolerate toxicity is different. I cannot give them Dex 40 milligrams, which I would give without blinking for a younger patient, because they will have significant cardiac decompensation. Also, diabetes can get worse, etc. And that will require more closer follow-up. So all these factors go into deciding how I would treat this patient. So the first consideration would be what agents I can use in this patient. And generally, the concept is, well, older patient, we would use melphalan prednisone, and that's what I entirely disagree with. We do not have to start with melphalan in this older patient population. We have drugs we can give quite safely, very effective, tolerated, and the remission can last longer without damaging the stem cell, blood counts, etc. So I do not use melphalan prednisone in this patient population. So in this particular case, I think I would hold bortezomib for later use, if at all. But I considered giving lenalidomide, oral agent, well-tolerated, and can be given safely. And with dexamethasone, because of his diabetes, hypertension, cardiac problem, he ended up getting dexamethasone at the 10 milligram weekly dosage, which he actually tolerated extremely well. Lenalidomide dose can be started at a full dose. His renal functions are normal, but one could consider lower dose also, 15 milligram, if there's any problem with tolerance.
So where is he currently?
So he got RD regimen, had an excellent response again. He has received the treatment now for almost, it's a little over a year and a half, has achieved a VGPR with very minimal protein detectable. Hemoglobin has improved to 12. And in fact, his cardiac function has slightly improved. Also, we don't know whether there was any element of amyloidosis present in this patient or not, but his cardiac function has slightly improved. His bone lesions, of course, they are present. However, he has no pains or any other thing. So his quality of life has significantly improved. He's now close to 86, but feeling well.
So just out of curiosity, if he were to develop progressive disease, what would be your next therapy?
So then we have multiple options in this day and age. With his neuropathy, one could consider a proteasome inhibitor, either carfilzomib, but we have to keep his cardiac problem in mind, or use bortezomib at a weekly dose and or sub-Q dose. So in bortezomib, there is reasonably clear data now that if you use weekly bortezomib, it is very well tolerated, and the incidence of neuropathy is also significantly less. Similar data exists for sub-Q. What we do not know is that if we use sub-Q weekly, does it provide the similar response, and is it even better than either of the weekly or sub-Qs done separately? So if one is to use a weekly regimen, I would use IV, which is what I prefer, or one could use sub-Q twice a week, which is more validated. In older patients, transportation problem, other comorbidities, I prefer to give weekly IV bortezomib, which provides excellent response, good tolerability, and neuropathy is not usually a major problem, which, of course, in this patient would need to be monitored closely.
So again, thinking about needing another therapy because of progression, where would pomalidomide fit in?
So I think in this patient, for example, when he relapses on RD, my inclination would be to go on proteasome inhibitor, probably IV bortezomib. And then if and when he relapses from them, I would consider pomalidomide as an extra option.
So kind of moving into more this issue of relapse refractory disease, let's talk about your 58-year-old patient who presented 5 years ago.
Yeah, so this is a young patient who was diagnosed in a standard way with myeloma, got at that time considered newer treatment, although standard now, got RVD, went through transplant, and received lenalidomide maintenance, which was discontinued after 2 years because that was around the time when there was some simmering news about, and it was a patient's choice to get off, as we discussed with patient what the data are. So he was followed without anything. He had mild neuropathy, of course, apparently from bortezomib from initial treatment. And then he had increase in paraprotein. He had achieved complete remission with immunofixation negativity, and he became immunofixation positive and had slight increase in paraprotein now to measurable 0.5 milligram per deciliter.
So I'm curious how you thought through treatment options, and what about the issue of when to start treatment? When the patient's stable, there's no clinical disease, and all you're dealing with is blood work. How do you decide when it's time to treat and when it's time to maybe hold off for a little bit?
So that's a critical question for relapse patient. And in a regular practice, that's what everybody faces. So classically, when patient achieves a complete remission and now he becomes immunofixation positive, that doesn't mean anything about restarting the treatment. Yes, we are now seeing the protein. No, it does not mean disease is progressing enough to intervene. In fact, we all had many patients, more than one, who became immunofixation positive and remained that way for 6, 8, 12 months on the maintenance or no maintenance. So there are two criteria being used to treat relapse myeloma patient. One is what is called symptomatic relapse, which would mean that patients, one of the four end organ damage has now recurred. So patient comes up with new bone lesion, he develops new hypercalcemia, he has deterioration of renal function, which was normal, now getting worse, or was abnormal but getting worse, or patient has increasing anemia. If any of these four features are there, it's a clear symptomatic relapse or new plasmacytoma. Clear symptomatic relapse needs to be treated quite soon. The second emerging criteria, and we had a consensus conference as part of this Paris workshop, and the manuscript is prepared, which also then defined clinically significant relapse, which says that if the paraproteins are doubling very quickly, M-spike more than 1 gram, Benjamin's protein more than 500 milligram per deciliter, or light chain increased by 200, and if two of those happen within a short period of time, then even though it may not have reached one of our artificially designed criteria of more than 1 gram per deciliter, there's a fast progression, patients should be treated. So either symptomatic relapse or clinically significant relapse are observed, then we should intervene. In the other setting, one could carefully follow the patient periodically, but they need to be followed more frequently. I cannot then have him come back in 3 months. He needs to come back monthly to get the numbers done and see what's changing or not.
So I'm trying to predict in my own mind what you did, and I've got it down to two possibilities, but I absolutely can't guess which one it was. Just to be clear, he's been off treatment for a couple of years, no residual neuropathy from the prior RVD. I don't know. I could see you using either carfilzomib or pomalidomide, and maybe you did something else.
No, he actually ended up getting pomalidomide with Dex as the next option. Either of the option would have been fine. There is not enough data whether a second line and subsequent treatment, if you use 3-drug versus 2-drug, there's any advantage of 3-drug. That's an unexplored territory at the moment. That is a situation where we are not yet sure whether minimal residual disease setting can and should be achieved, and it can or will be helpful, although getting best response is still our criteria. So in this setting, normal course ends up being using 2-drug regimen. In this particular case, it was pomalidomide Dex.
And what are the factors, because this is a very common question nowadays, that push you more towards pomalidomide, and what are the factors pushing you more towards carfilzomib?
So in this patient, he had mild neuropathy from initial treatment. So because of that, carfilzomib doesn't have as much problem, but it's still a proteasome inhibitor. So because of that, there was a skewing towards pomalidomide. We do know he was responsive to lenalidomide. It was not stopped because of progression. He didn't get it while getting progressive disease. It was quite okay to give pomalidomide. Also, it's convenient to take it. If this patient had relapse while being on lenalidomide maintenance, I would have used carfilzomib as my next option, keeping POM for the next relapse.
And how long would the patient have to be off lenalidomide for you to start thinking about pomalidomide?
I think around 6 months or so. It's very arbitrary. It's very artificial. But if he relapses after 6 months, you could say that he was sensitive and then he has just relapsed as a natural disease. If he does relapse within the 6 months' time, you could argue that he was almost becoming resistant to the treatment anyway, so that the disease burden was present clearly. And once you stopped, it emerged immediately.
So what's his current situation?
So he remains on pomalidomide dex. He has it for now. He was on a study and he's done well for over 6+ months, achieving good remission and again, normal quality of life for now. He does have stem cells stored from the previous time that one could consider at a later point in time.
Anything that you've observed in terms of the use of pomalidomide, anything that's different about using pomalidomide from a side effects or, you know, a clinical point of view compared to lenalidomide, other than, you know, the activity spectrum, but clinically, what's it been like to use the drug?
It's a very easy to use oral drug, similar precaution as lenalidomide. I think blood counts need to be monitored a little bit more closely. There are situations, not in this patient, but there are many other heavily pretreated patients where we quite liberally use G-CSF to keep the blood counts up and to maintain the treatment. And that's one of the differences with lenalidomide, that blood counts problem, especially white cells, can be observed more frequently and might need to be maintained by G-CSF use to allow proper dosage of the drug.
Same question about carfilzomib. Now that it's out there and, you know, people are getting more experience with it, what are you observing in your own practice about using the drug?
So I think it's a very quite effective drug. We combine it with various other drugs as similar to what we have done with bortezomib, in the sense you can combine very well with Cytoxan. We have combined it with bendamustine, combined it with lenalidomide, and all these combinations are effective in one way or another. I think the two issues to successive day dosing can be a little bit inconvenient, although in the setting that patients usually get, that's not their major problem. Their disease is the major concern, so they're quite compliant about it. The second thing to keep in mind is still simmering, emerging understanding of the toxicity in regards to cardiac problems and or pulmonary problem, which we closely monitor, do more frequently if required, pre-screening with echo and other investigation to look for any cardiac problem up front and then monitor during the treatment.
I've been trying to get a handle on that ever since I first started to hear about carfilzomib. We did a survey of 25 myeloma investigators recently. One of the questions we asked them is, have you observed any dyspnea with it? And almost every one of the investigators had seen like one patient or two. Everybody had seen it, you know, very, very uncommonly. And kind of reading the comments, I was trying to figure out sort of how it comes together. What's your concept right now about the cardiac effect, the pulmonary effect, and this clinical syndrome of dyspnea?
So I think probably a mixture of both. We do know that bortezomib can also cause pneumonitis. Actually, there's a little older study in Japanese population where it was observed, not as much in Caucasian population. So we do know that proteasome inhibitor, that is bortezomib, can have pulmonary effect. My personal thinking for carfilzomib is that it's both. The pulmonary effects could be something similar, but over and above that, there's a cardiac issue. So depending upon what patient's baseline cardiac and pulmonary function is, each may contribute to have a problem, especially in those patients where it happens.
And another thing I've heard brought up in this context is the hydration that's given with the drug. Do you think this is contributing to it? How do you hydrate patients? And when you see the syndrome, when do you see it?
So I think that's also kind of interesting. I think hydration is quite often necessary, although it is attributed to the pulmonary problem and the settings where it has not been considered, so that we don't overload the patient. What we have to wait and see is that does this happen when we give it to a newly diagnosed, healthy, younger patient compared to what it has been used so far by most of the practicing physician in an advanced disease, heavily pretreated, post-transplant, post other things done. and see what the frequency is. And so that's one aspect about hydration. It may be necessary, however, it could exacerbate the symptoms that we would observe. And so one has to be careful in that regard. The second part is, when do we see it? It's usually seen more sooner than later. There are more fewer cases where it would be seen after the four cycles. It's usually seen in the earlier part of the treatment, at least in my personal experience, although I know my colleagues have seen it at a later time point too.
So if a patient comes in and they describe, you know, being somewhat short of breath, you don't really find anything specific in examining them, how much further do you carry out a workup and what do you do?
So if patient is going to go on it, we do echocardiogram to see what the cardiac status is. And if there is a doubt that there is some pulmonary background problem, we do PFTs to know where we are starting out with, so that if there are problems, we can compare and see what got deteriorated. I think part of the ongoing studies with carfilzomib, it's almost mandated so that we have baselines before and after to see what is changing, how much, and then how much can we attribute to his disease, hydration, and other things in regards to symptoms.
Do you consider the presence of heart failure or underlying pulmonary disease, COPD, et cetera, a contraindication to the drug? Or if it's the best drug for the patient, will you use it?
So, no, it is not a contraindication. I think it is a good drug. It is effective in a setting where other drugs may not be effective. So I would not totally rule the drug out. The way it goes into the algorithm of treatment is that if a patient has those background COPD and or CHF and or other cardiac problem, that won't be my first drug to go to if I have an option. So when we run out of the option, I would give carfilzomib with close monitoring. If it deteriorates, we can stop. If not, we continue.
Another question we've gotten quite a bit is whether or not there's an oral formulation of carfilzomib. There is an agent, ixazomib, that seems like it's kind of similar to bortezomib that's being developed oral. What about this drug, and is there an oral formulation of carfilzomib? And do you think, you know, that this is something that we're going to be doing in the future?
Yeah, no, there are both, oral bortezomib, and there is an oral carfilzomib, both in clinical investigation. Oral bortezomib is further along, has shown good efficacy in combination as well as single agent. It has been combined with all things that you can consider, including lenalidomide and others. It's convenient, it's oral, toxicity profile appears pretty good so far in the studies that have been presented. And so it is going through the usual cycle of its approval. Oral carfilzomib had some initial issues about formulation and other. It's also moving at a little slower pace in identifying its role and its activity in various settings. A critical question for success of this drug is going to be, how effective are the oral agents? Are they close to, similar to, within the margin of error of IV and subcutaneous dosages, or are they much inferior to them? And that is going to determine what their role would be. The important part would be, they can be given for maintenance, and they would have a clear role in long-term maintenance for sure.
And it seems like that'd be a great way to use it. I want to close out by asking you about new agents in myeloma, but one thing I realized I meant to ask you before about your 84-year-old man, which is, when you have older patients on non-transplant situation, what's your long-term strategy in terms of their management? It kind of seems from the outside, like over the last few years, it seems like I'm hearing more about trying to keep these kinds of people on therapy for longer periods of time. Is that the way you approach it?
I think so. I think a healthy older person, healthy in the sense functionally active, not necessarily cardiopulmonary health, but functionally active person, we would maintain them on treatment like I would do any other patient. They're functional. On the other hand, if they're not functional, then we might want to take a treatment approach where we may give the treatment, have a treatment-free period so that it doesn't have a cumulative problem, and then retreat when needed.
So in terms of new agents, first I'm curious what your thoughts are about elotuzumab. Could you explain what it is, what we know about it, and where you think it's heading?
So elotuzumab hopefully would be the Rituxan for myeloma, we are hoping. It's an antibody against a target on myeloma cell called CS1. It is by itself as a single agent has not shown any efficacy, minimal to no efficacy. But when combined with lenalidomide, it provides excellent results based on, we have laboratory research data which shows why it might be the case. And that has been translated into clinical setting where one sees over 80 to 85% responses when both the drugs are combined, which is far more than lenalidomide dexamethasone would be by itself, close to 50-55%. So this combination is very exciting. has finished phase 3 study. We are awaiting the results. Hopefully next month to a year, we should know how well it works, and hopefully it will live up to the expectation that we have.
It's interesting that you made the analogy to rituximab, because in lymphoma nowadays, we're hearing a lot about the R-squared regimen of rituximab, lenalidomide. Any thoughts about what's going on mechanistically when you have an IMiD like lenalidomide with a monoclonal antibody like elotuzumab or rituximab?
So what is happening immunologically is that lenalidomide is a non-immunomodulatory drug. It belongs to the same class as it's called immunomodulatory drug. And it improves the activity of the NK cells and to some extent T cells. And the antibodies, they work also through the ADCC mechanism, antibody-dependent cytotoxicity. So antibody binds to the tumor cells, which are then recognized well by these cytotoxic cells and kills them. So we have antibody binding, lenalidomide improving the ADCC, increasing together the killing of the tumor cells, getting the better results. That happens in R-squared, that happens in elotuzumab and lenalidomide.
Any other agents that you're excited about that you think maybe have a decent shot of coming onto clinical practice in the next few years?
So there is another antibody which is very exciting. There are two agents, I would say. Daratumumab, and there are a few other similar targeting agents, which targets CD38, which is on myeloma cells quite uniformly. This drug antibody by itself as a single agent has shown activity, which for us is very exciting because very few drugs in heavily pretreated patient population shows activity. So that is something to watch for. Of course, it will be used in combinations also, and it is very fast going through the various clinical studies, and that's the most exciting. The second class of agent which has survived, although not succeeded yet, are the HDAC inhibitors. There are a number of HDAC inhibitors in clinical investigation. There's romidopsin, there's benabinostat, which have actually finished phase 3 studies. There was a study done with vorinostat. A phase 3 study was positive, but not strong enough to be very excited about. But it does establish that combination of proteasome inhibitor with HDAC inhibitor provides superior responses that, when used in proper dosages and schedule, might lead to survival benefits too. So these are the two class of agent which I think are right at the horizon of where they may eventually become part of our treatment algorithm.